number 255. We've been asked to mark that, and not only are we happy to do that, but we'll use that later in our service, of course. Certainly we can add to the thought of our joy today that this first day of the week has brought us together on an occasion like this one, that we may offer our heartfelt homage and obeisance to God, and for that we're so thankful. Certainly Denise and the family and I, happy to be back here today. I know a couple of gospel meetings, and certainly very thankful for your prayers and your well wishes in regard to them, and thankful for your presence. Several of you came to the meeting at Montrose, as well as the meeting that took place over at Oak Grove in White County, and so very thankful to see you and your support and encouragement. Very, very happy indeed about that. I know that as we come back together today, could I ask you to think about the plains of Ono? Now, that may be a place unfamiliar to you, at least geographically, but likely it's a place that quite familiar to all of us is in light of certain features of our life. I hope you'll be turning to Nehemiah, the 6th chapter, for it's in that location that we shall encounter the plain of Ono. And as we encounter that plain, we'll seek to not only discuss it, placing it into its historical context in the Bible, but we'll also draw some appreciations from it that can be a blessing and a very great encouragement to you and me as well. As you close that particular slide, that is an introductory one, all I'm going to do with that is merely say that a bit of introduction, I think, will be in order as we arrive at Nehemiah, the 6th chapter, so that we can be prepared to discuss what follows it. This slide is my attempt to do that. The children of Israel, specifically those of Judah, had returned from captivity. Don't you know that had to be a time of great encouragement? They had been 70 years in captivity. They were permitted by God to return. They needed to not only rebuild the temple, but to re-put in place the features of correct and proper and godly service and worship. You'll notice on that slide, that rebuilding project is described for us in the book of Ezra. We'll not certainly take the time to read all of Ezra, but what I could do is quickly say this. The books of Ezra, Haggai, and Zechariah share with us the interest in rebuilding and God's motivation to them for that. But you and I are more interested in Nehemiah, so we need to get to that, and we'll do that like this. Ezra came back to Jerusalem in 458 B.C. It was about 13 years later when Nehemiah came. And what did he find? He found a city, though there was a temple there, they had rebuilt that. The walls of the city had never been repaired. The walls, you see, were broken down. They were in disrepair, and obviously that left the city open to attack. It left the city, you see, in a very set of dire straits indeed. I suppose you and I know Nehemiah best for his work in motivating the people to rebuild those walls of Jerusalem. But may I say to you, he did more than that. In the 13 chapters of Nehemiah, we learn that he also motivated them to greater spiritual service. He motivated them and compelled them to invest their talents rightly directed by way of living in the service of God. I would offer you the thought that historically, Nehemiah is the last great leader the Old Testament records for us, for the people of God. We may well have started with men like Noah, but we end up with a man like Nehemiah. Courageous, brave, bold, committed, devoted, and he can serve as a great example in many ways for you and for me. But as far as looking at what he did, I think we now need to come to chapter 6. I'd like to read verses 1 and 2 of Nehemiah 6. And now, with those few words of preparation, look with me at this. Now, it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arabian and the rest of our enemies heard that I had builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, Come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me mischief. The circumstance then moved like this. You'll notice that for some amount of time, effort and work had been invested, and at least some amount of returning to the walls and the rebuilding thereof had taken place. And now verse number 1 quickly brings to us this observation. It came to pass when Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, and the rest of our enemies. Could I point out to you that here was a great work. It was an powerfully important work, and yet there was the presence of enemies. There were those who wished to not only resist that work to bring it to naught, they wished to, in fact, crush the good work and the effort that Nehemiah and those laborers were putting forth. You'll notice three of their names are given: Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. Now, in the book of Nehemiah, those three, sadly enough, are mentioned pretty often. Could I offer you a few thoughts that I've shared with you on that slide that I think each of us can not only relate to, but also use by way of wisdom? There was resistance and there was opposition to what Nehemiah was trying to accomplish. May I suggest to you and me, there will be opposition and resistance to those good programs, good projects, good elements of our lives. There always will be. And that resistance may well be couched in languages such as these. In 1 John 4, verse number 1, there in the heart of the New Testament, "Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits whether they be of God, for there are many false prophets going out into the world." One of the resistances then to the truth of God shall come in the presence and in the form of those that teach falsely, those who do not teach it as God delivered it, those who choose to insert their opinions, their speculations, or otherwise, and they twist and pervert it. Now that word "pervert" is the very one so appropriately used in 2 Peter 3, verses 17 and 18. It is there that that perversion, even Peter highlighted it. One of the first things to notice, the good work coming from the truth of God can well meet its opposition at times in the form of those who preach something not true. You and I must be confident and thankful for the truth of God and for the circumstances in which it is preached in power and truthfulness and majesty. But may I say, it's not only opposition in forms like that. There will be personal opposition. Now that's things you and I face individually. It may be someone else doesn't face it the same way. Would you think for a moment about the circumstances of your life? Be it your occupation, be it the circumstances of your family, be it the particular matters in which you are surviving and living. It's always true. The devil is not going to enjoy you pursuing great godliness in the particulars of your walk of life. And there will be bastions of strength arrayed against you. Some of that will be related to personal choices. Some of it will be related to the other matters that are brought upon you by your acquaintances and associations. But all the while, isn't it true, we need to be strong. You and I are going to ask in just a minute, how did Nehemiah react to this? He's got three enemies now and a host more that are unnamed. How did he react? Was he able to withstand? Was he able to, in fact, emerge with victory in light of these enemies? I'll give it to the answer in a minute, but I want you to take note it turns out well. For right now, look at what else is on that slide. One of the greatest enemies, I suppose, that could have been a challenge to those of Nehemiah's day, would you think about the task of rebuilding this wall? Anybody that's ever swung a sledgehammer or a hammer, you know how hard work that can be. Wouldn't it have been easy for some of these folks to say, "Look, we've been living here for a while now and made it without a wall. Are you really sure we need it? It sure feels a lot better sitting over there in the shade." And yet, Nehemiah, encouraged, motivated, and they overcame any indifference or apathy that might have been the case, and they proceeded to rebuild that wall. May I point out that one of the features that you and I sometimes face is to overcome the indifference that might otherwise be the case. To take an initiative and to move forward with a given effort in light of the fact it'll require work on our part. Aren't you thankful that the parable of the talent still reminds us that that five-talent man, as well as the two-talent man, did put into practice and into effort that which had been given to them? It was the one-talent man who was so resoundingly judged because he didn't put into practice and didn't put into utility that which he had been given. What talents have you been given by God? And what about me? What skills and capacities do you have access to? May each of us use them. May we, in fact, employ them to the great service of God, to the blessing of ourselves and others, and do that in a way that offers the glory and majesty to the one that gave it to us. As far as the days of Nehemiah, let's close that slide like this. The first two verses have brought us to note that there was opposition. But did you notice they had what sounded like a very kind invitation? Come down and meet with us, Nehemiah, in the plain of Ono. May I suggest to you that name is a very memorable one. Ono. So here's a map that shows you where Ono was. May I suggest to you that that's sort of a blown-up picture. You may notice that Joppa, perhaps a well-known city over on the coast, might give you some geographical position of at least where we're located. We're somewhat north in Israel. At this point, notice, though, that Ono is on a nicely positioned plain. You may notice Aphek is not too far to the north. And that, of course, is ultimately where David defeated Goliath. But again, that's history at this point. Would you appreciate that knowing now where Ono was, let's reflect on verses 3 and following. Let me continue the reading. Keeping in mind what we've discussed so far, let's now think of it like this. And I sent messengers unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease whilst I leave it and come down to you? Yet they sent unto me four times after this sort, and I answered them after the same manner. Then sent Sanballat his servant unto me in like manner the fifth time with an open letter in his hand, wherein was written, It is reported among the heathen, and Gashmu saith it, that thou and the Jews think to rebel, for which cause thou buildest the wall, that thou mayest be their king according to these words. I'll pause there before we read on. Can you position in your mind what these enemies have now done? Did you notice? They sent to Nehemiah not once, not twice, not thrice, but four times initially. May I say the enemy doesn't give up. Those issues that you and I noted that we face personally, they're not only going to be faced once, most likely. They will rise more than once. And you and I must be dedicated in strength to know how to overwhelm them each time. Not only that, did you notice Nehemiah's initial response? I am doing a great work. I cannot come down and waste my time messing with you on this occasion. Do you see in Nehemiah a strong element of judgment? A strong element of proper perspective in light of what was being done and the character of his sense of who these people were. As you go back to the closing statement of verse 2, they thought to do me mischief. They didn't have his best interest at heart and the work of rebuilding the wall at Jerusalem. In addition to that, look what else we're told. Verse number 5. Sanballat now developed another idea. He sent the fifth time, and this time there was an open letter. What'd the letter say? Verse 6 says, the letter made a claim, there's been a report that you're rebuilding this wall so that you can be the king of Jerusalem. And furthermore, verse 7 says, thou hast appointed prophets to preach at Jerusalem, saying there is a king in Judah. Now Sanballat's getting more desperate. Isn't it true the enemy, once he is rebuffed, will often intensify his efforts? That's what Sanballat did. Nehemiah didn't fall for the first attempt to meet at the plain of Ono. So now Sanballat resorts to another idea. So he sent a letter that no doubt appeared official. And did you notice in verse number 6, there's a reference to Gashmu saith it. Apparently that was an official who gave some element of credibility to the letter. The letter said, Nehemiah, you're going to make yourself king. And that's why you're rebuilding the wall. Now this time, you'll notice, this carries a greater weight. Remember, at this particular time, there was a foreign power in control of this area. And if the foreign power perceived that Nehemiah was rebelling against them, indeed they might come and stop the rebuilding. And they might bring the work to naught. So now Nehemiah has another effort to deal with. Let's see how he handled it. Verse number 8, Then I sent unto him, saying, There are no such things as thou sayest, but thou feignest them out of thine own heart. The next thing you and I notice, Sanballat lied. Nehemiah never intended to be king at Jerusalem. He never constructed any idea relative to the occurrence of this. And so Nehemiah says, what you're saying not only is not true, it has not been true. You made it up. That's a pretty direct and powerful way of dealing with it, isn't it? Now what about the enemies that you face and those perhaps at your workplace or others? Are there times when there are open lies that are thus told as if it was something else? Nehemiah just bluntly said, what you said is not true. I have no intention to be king at Jerusalem, and nothing like that has ever been mentioned here before. Notice the next verse. For they all made us afraid. Verse number 9. Fear is one of the greatest tactics in light of an enemy. To bring to fear and to bring to afraidness and to bring to thus naught in light of fear. And that's what Sanballat tried. As you pause long enough to note this, their hands shall be weakened from the work that it be not done. Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, they had an agenda. They didn't just send these letters to Nehemiah with hope for conversation. They wanted the work to stop, and they wanted it to produce no further movement forward. They've resorted to two things already in an effort to bring this about. It won't be the last. Every congregation and every individual who attempts to be a faithful Christian is going to face opposition, and it will arise in a variety of places and in a variety of forms. And every time, we need the wisdom of Nehemiah to not only see it for what it is, but to reply to it with directness and with strength. As you come near the bottom of that slide, could I point out to you, now we arrive at verse number 10. I've already mentioned to you that the work already is such that Sanballat resorted to a plan B. Now there's a resort to plan C. Would you note what it is? May I read verse 10. Afterward I came, the eyes of Nehemiah, into the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut up. And he said, Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us shut the doors of the temple. For they will come to slay thee, yea, in the night will they come to slay thee. Would you at least picture, if I may paraphrase, some of what was just described? And so now we're introduced to another person, whose name is, afterward I came to the house of Shemaiah. So Shemaiah apparently is the one sharing these pieces of information. He says, Nehemiah, you and I need to go into the temple and shut the doors because you're in a very difficult position. There's going to be people to come to kill you. In the interest of saving your life, let's go into the temple and lock ourselves in there. Now, would you think about the fear that had captivated perhaps many, and now they're trying to again bring Nehemiah into a place. He can't oversee the work if he stays in the temple all the time. If he stays in there with doors locked, that will also, it would seem, accomplish somewhat of resisting the work, but it will save Nehemiah's life, apparently. At least that's Shemaiah's claim. Put yourself in that position. If your life was threatened that way, would you have attempted it? Would you have gone into the temple, locked the door, and stay there? Fear can cause you and me to put our light under a basket. I guess one of the best VBS songs that we teach our youngsters, "I'll let my light shine, I'll put it under a basket." No. And you and I might be tempted to hide our Christianity because we're afraid of what someone might say, afraid of what someone might say in reaction. I hope you and I won't do that. Aren't we encouraged to be a light that shines forth for the whole room? A city that's set on a hill. We're encouraged, you see, to be the salt of the earth. That statement, or set of statements, in Matthew 5, verses 13 to 16, I suppose is culminated like this: "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." Matthew 5, verse 16. You begin to see they were attempting to snuff out the impression, the influence that Nehemiah was able to have. I know you're anxious to know, how'd Nehemiah react? Next verse. "And I said, should such a man as I flee? And who is there that, being as I am, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." How about that? Nehemiah saw through that which Shemaiah described. "You're asking me to run and hide." He did use the word flee, didn't he? "You're asking me thus to hide in that way." And Nehemiah said, "I won't do it." And his explanation in the next few verses is so very resounding. Verse number 12, "And lo, I perceive that God had not sent him, but that he pronounced his prophecy against me, for Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him." What may at first have seemed so reasonable, you notice that Shemaiah was a paid man. He had been hired by Sanballat and Tobiah to come and bring that message to Nehemiah. It wasn't real. There was no direct threat on Nehemiah's life that way. But one more time, isn't the enemy crafty? To play on our fears and our concerns. And here, isn't it true that for fear of a person's life, you'll do many things? But yet, what Shemaiah had said, he had been hired to say it. Oh, isn't that interesting? And so now, verse number 13, "Therefore was he hired, that I should be afraid and do so and sin, and that they might have matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me." Had Nehemiah done this, he said, that would have been sin on my part. It would have resulted in a sinful response by me. And it would furthermore have led to a report, evil in nature, that they could have used against me. Are you beginning to sense that those, certainly in places of position and authority, they are expected by God to behave in a rather powerful and dramatic way? But yea, all of us as Christians, the enemy has now resorted to several things to bring the work to naught. Let's read on. Verse 14, "My God, think thou upon Tobiah and Sanballat according to these their works, and on the prophet Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets that would have put me in fear." We have mention made of a prophetess by name, Noadiah. She, as well as some other prophets, were not prophets of God. They actively labored against Nehemiah and would, in fact, have brought that work to naught. And may you and I remember how we began the lesson. Enemies can often parade as if they are very noble, trustworthy people, but they are not. They, in fact, will cause the work of God to come to naught and the betterment of your life and mine individually. Interestingly, Nehemiah just simply prayed, "God, think thou upon them for what they've done." Surely in that light, could I bring you to verse 15? What about a bright spot? We've seen enough negative ones. So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. In 52 days, they finished this wall, the extensiveness of it, the thoroughness and completeness of it, and did it in a month and a half. How impressive to give thought to that accomplishment. And all the while there were enemies, and all the while there were those that sought to bring the work to naught, but Nehemiah prevailed in wisdom, in leadership, and the people followed that example. As you close that slide, verse 16 now allows me to say this, "And it came to pass that when all our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God." The work of God proceeded. The enemies were cast down. There, in fact, you may remember how the Bible uses the phrase sometimes, "their countenance fell." Notice the enemy's countenance fell in this case, because Nehemiah, in wisdom, led this work as it ought to have been. At this point, could I then say that I think that there are several quick observations you and I can make, some of which are summaries, but some of which will take us to some additional verses. First of all, aren't you impressed with the self-awareness of Nehemiah? He perceived that this Gashmu, and he perceived that Shemaiah, and he perceived that these others, that the things that they were presenting were not the truth. It often takes a fair amount of perception to see through what the appearance that the enemy makes. The enemy can make it look good, noble, even proper. But you and I should never forget that isn't it true that Satan himself can transform himself into an angel of light? 2 Corinthians 11, verse 14. That means self-awareness is very useful, so let's apply that personally. As you and I, we know ourselves better than anyone else. May you and I always take to heart, though, and properly examine ourselves and not put ourselves in positions where we might have a hard time appreciating that which really is of the enemy. In Matthew 10, verse 16, aren't we encouraged there to be as wise as serpents and harmless as doves? You see, even Jesus encouraged His disciples as He sent them out on that limited commission. "You're going to be going in places and I won't be with you. You need to be as wise as a serpent." Now you and I know snakes, serpents if you please, they are subtle, crafty, and wise. And Jesus encourages us not to be like them in every way, but to be like them in terms of wisdom. Secondly, what about fear? Surely one of the most often used tools in the workshop of the devil is fear. How often has the devil brought at least a conception of fear into your life and mine? And so a given work is never pursued because we're afraid of what might happen, what someone might say, what the reaction might be. Gentlemen, can you remember a time when maybe you hadn't been a Christian that long and you were first asked to lead a prayer in public? Or maybe first asked to lead singing or have some other play serving at the table or otherwise? You remember being a bit afraid? Can I do this successfully and properly and in a way that doesn't distract from the service? Isn't it a reminder that as you and I address it, a little nervousness isn't a bad thing? It keeps us on our toes. It helps us be committed to carrying out the work rightly and correctly. But may we not allow years to pass in which that fear handcuffs us and prevents us from doing what we otherwise could. In the same way, gentlemen, what about the first time you were asked to teach a Bible class or to deliver a devotional service? One more time, nervousness isn't a bad thing at all. But if we allow fear to grip us to the point that we never agree to do it, is there a talent God has given me that I am refusing to use? If so, that is not good. Ladies, you can perhaps mention things of you, be it teaching classes, various other activities that you might be capable of doing. Fear can be a very powerful resisting force. What about the last one, the lesson of commitment? Nehemiah came back to Jerusalem. And when he came back, don't you know that when he saw the wall in this mess, how his heart must have been overwhelmed in the magnitude of the work that was required. And yet, through it all, he never wavered and never deviated. Committed to that work, may you and I be committed to Christianity in every way. Be thou faithful unto death, is what it says. No matter what the challenge, no matter what the reality, no matter what the opposition, and no matter how it appears, that you and I will be faithful in every regard. I would say all that to say this in point of conclusion. We have revisited the plain of Ono this morning. And could I say that in essence, Nehemiah put to practice the very name of that place. When they invited him to come, he said, "Oh no, I will not come." Somewhat interestingly, as the name of the place, that in essence reminds us of Nehemiah's reply. And may I point out that when it comes to the things like being cuffed in fear or being moved by these other things that are negative, you and I too should respond like he, "Oh no, we will not be moved in that direction, but we will be moved in commitment to follow that which is of the Lord." I hope the plain of Ono has been a good lesson for not only church leaders, but for all of us today, to be motivated in service and motivated to ever have the awareness and vision and the wisdom to react in the way of God. Speaking of reacting in the way of God, it's God's desire that everybody be a faithful Christian, everyone who's reached an age of knowing wrong from right. And today, if there be someone in this assembly of whom that's not true, why do you delay? Why do you wait? The greatness of the enemy might now be using fear. Isn't there a better day, better time, another opportunity? Well, there will never be a better day than this one. Today is the day of salvation, to borrow the words of 2 Corinthians 6, verse 2. And today, if we could be of assistance in that way, won't you believe in Jesus, the one who died for you? Believing in the salvation His blood makes available, won't you repent of your sins? The very things that nailed Him to that cross, we learn in 1 Peter chapter 2. Won't you make confession of His name and won't you be baptized? We'd be delighted to assist in that way. If you, however, are a wayward child of God, one who has left your first love, you too need to believe that Jesus can and will forgive you. But you need to repent of those sins and you need to confess them. And you need today to allow us, in acknowledgement of that characteristic, that we could certainly approach God in prayer. And today, if we could be of some help, won't you be wise and won't you respond as together we stand and as we sing.